Hello and welcome. My name is Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, and I'm founder and president of the Israel Project. On behalf of our entire board and staff, I'm very pleased that such a large group could join us on the phone today to hear from Jonathan Chanzer, Deputy Executive Director of the Jewish Policy Center and an author of a very exciting new book, Hamas versus Fatah, The Struggle for Palestine. We're so happy to have him with us here today. Jonathan will give us a brief presentation, and then we'll get some of your questions answered from our audience and from the reporters who have sent them online. I want to let you know that if you didn't already send a question in, that you can do so by emailing in michaelw@theisraelproject.org. That's michaelw@theisraelproject.org. Before joining the Jewish Policy Center, Jonathan Chanzer was a counterterrorism analyst for the Office of Intelligence and Analysis at the U.S. Department of Treasury. Prior to joining the Treasury, he served as a research fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, where he authored the book Al-Qaeda's Armies, Middle East Affiliate Groups, and the Next Generation of Terror. He also participated in a Washington Institute fact-finding mission in Iraq in 2004. Mr. Chanzer got his start in the policy world as a research fellow at the Middle East Forum, a Philadelphia-based think tank headed by scholar Daniel Pipes. Mr. Chanzer holds a bachelor degree from Emory University, which is also my alma mater, and is a master's degree from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Middle Eastern Studies, where I also studied, so I'm especially delighted to have him with us today. He also studied Arabic at the American University in Cairo in 2001. He's currently a PhD candidate at King's College documenting the history of the United States Congress and its efforts to combat terrorism. Mr. Chanzer has published numerous scholarly articles, journal pieces, a national newspaper editorials, and magazine features. He has appeared with frequency on American television channels such as Fox News and CNN, as well as on Arab television channels such as Al Jazeera. Mr. Chanzer has traveled widely in Iraq, Yemen, Egypt, Morocco, Kuwait, Qatar, Turkey, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He speaks Arabic and Hebrew. Jonathan Chanzer, we are delighted to have you with us here. You now have the floor.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jennifer, and it is an honor to be on this call with the Israel Project, and an honor to be introduced by an Emory and Hebrew University graduate as well. I will take the next 10 minutes or so to talk about my book, but also to think about some of the implications of recent events that have impacted what I had written, and want to call your attention to a few things that I think have come to light since Operation Cast Lead. So I'll begin with that and looking at the Israeli operation in Gaza of December 2008 and January 2009. What I think was interesting and that I think really did not get enough play in the mainstream media and perhaps in academic circles was this was the first time, to my knowledge, that Israel was engaged in military operations in one Palestinian territory and not the other. In other words, as we've seen in the past, when there is regional war or when Israel is engaged in hostilities with the Palestinians, it has usually been in both the West Bank and Gaza Strip simultaneously, thinking about perhaps the 1987-88 Intifada, the first Intifada, or the Al-Aqsa Intifada, as it was called in 2000. What we saw was a joint effort on the part of both Palestinian territories. In this case, in Operation Cast Lead, one territory was where all the action took place in the Gaza Strip, while the other one watched somewhat quietly. Yes, there were a few Fatah demonstrations or Palestinian Authority demonstrations, but most of them were relatively small in number and in intensity. And on top of that, we saw that there were some reports of Fatah or Palestinian Authority officials providing targeting information to the Israeli military in order to help the Israelis neutralize their Hamas foes in Gaza. And even actually in the early goings of the operation, before Israelis put boots on the ground in Gaza, when it was just an air operation, there were even some public statements of understanding of Israel's positions issued by Palestinian leaders. So this was, in my opinion, a drastic change compared to what we had seen in the past, and certainly worth noting, and I don't think that this got enough attention. But I do believe that the Arab League, the organization of the Islamic Conference, and in particular Egypt, did take note of this. And I believe that they realized the facade of Palestinian unity had completely collapsed with Operation Cast Lead. And it was for this reason that Cairo held unity talks very recently, started them in March of this, earlier this month. The Cairo talks were designed to create a polity that would be acceptable in the eyes of the international community. In other words, one that could accept international aid and help rebuild Gaza. This policy was really designed to downplay the role of Hamas, but to bring Hamas into the fold so that the Palestinians could begin to speak with one voice again, rather than to be split as they had been, where, you know, as we have right now, you've got the West Bank that is controlled by Fatah, you've got the Gaza Strip that is controlled by Hamas, and there is a cacophony of voices coming out of both territories, and it's been very difficult to understand who to work with, who to provide aid to, and so Cairo attempted to mitigate this chaos. In early March, as these debates were going on, I went on the Al Hora Arabic channel that is sponsored by the United States and debated some Palestinian analysts about the prospects of these talks. And I made the argument that until the role of Iran was neutralized, in other words, Iran has essentially exacerbated the Palestinian conflict by funding Hamas and providing weapons and training to Hamas, that this conflict would continue and would probably only get worse. And I believe that this has essentially come true. Really, last week, despite some small progress that was reported in the five committees that were created to bridge the gaps between Hamas and Fatah, the talks broke down. Cairo last week announced that the two sides would return to their fiefdoms in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and that new reconciliation talks will now be held in Cairo in early April. But there will be a new strategy involved. They're going to try to bridge some of the more sticky issues and sort of stop talking about the brass tacks of a unity government, but really just try to get the two sides on the same page. So what we're looking at really right now is a very fractured Palestinian political landscape. And we even have seen it just in the last week that the fissures continue to grow. The Ma'an news agency reported that Fatah's foreign minister, Riyad al-Maliki, had actually warned the Europeans not to soften their positions vis-a-vis Hamas. As everybody knows, there's been a lot of talk about bringing Hamas into the mainstream dialogue, and this is something that Fatah does not want. And then in probably a less reported story, the deputy head of the PLO in Lebanon, Kamal Medhat, was killed by a roadside bomb near a refugee camp, and Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority chairman, called this a terrorist crime, and Hamas is strongly suspected. As a matter of fact, Hamas wouldn't even allow for a funeral to take place inside the Gaza Strip because of this person's political affiliation, the fact that he's aligned with Fatah and the PLO. But what all this boils down to, and what I have been stating repeatedly, is that the differences that we have observed within the Palestinians in the war, I mean, we can, I think, decidedly call this a civil war, has made it so that nobody knows who to talk to. And this has created a situation whereby if Israel decided miraculously that it was going to relinquish control of the entire West Bank tomorrow and pull up all checkpoints, that it was going to remove all strictures around the Gaza Strip, it would return parts of Jerusalem to Muslim hands, that it would allow for a certain number of refugees to live in Israel, there would be nobody on the Palestinian side to ratify such an agreement. And this is, in fact, making the prospect of resuming the peace process infinitely more difficult. Now, apart from this, I mean, I just briefly reviewed some of the political complications. And what I talk about in my book is also a question of geography. There are some geographic questions that have been raised by the Palestinian Civil War. I believe it's in chapter 12 of my book where I talk about the fact that there is more separating the two Palestinian territories, the West Bank and Gaza Strip, than 20 to 30 miles of the Negev Desert. Prior to 1967, when Israel took control of these territories, they were under Egyptian and Jordanian control. After Israel conquered them, there was talk of uniting them under one Palestinian flag with the end goal of creating some sort of a Palestinian state under the auspices of a final status peace agreement. And in fact, Israel began to talk about highways or bridges or tunnels that would connect these two territories together. And in fact, this was to be considered some sort of a contiguous Palestinian state. The launch of the Al-Aqsa Intifada in 2000 set the Palestinians back in ways that are hard to imagine. In other words, rather than try to enable the Palestinians to connect these two territories, the Israelis determined that in order to prevent further suicide bombings and attacks against civilians, that they would need to build the security fence or wall. And have done that, have completed the wall around the Gaza Strip and are mostly done around the West Bank, while all the while hammering Palestinian Authority infrastructure. In other words, this was Yasser Arafat, who had launched the war in 2000, and he was legitimately punished for launching this war. When Arafat died in 2004, the Palestinian Authority infrastructure had essentially all but collapsed, and it was as if he alone had held these two territories together. And it was at that point that observers quietly began to observe that the clan and family, the sort of traditional Arab power brokers that were affiliated with Hamas and Fatah, controlled territories throughout the West Bank and Gaza. In other words, there were little Bantustans within the West Bank and Gaza, and we began to see the unraveling of the Palestinian territories. The Hamas coup in 2007 cemented the isolation of these two territories. And Israel continued to make sure that these borders were sealed and the travel was virtually impossible between the two of them. And today, in the aftermath of Operation Cast Lead, we see two drastically different political entities. One is still smoldering and needs billions to rebuild, and one is intact and is in fact receiving U.S. aid and European aid and international aid writ large. Then we also have one polity, the Gaza Strip, that is Islamist in nature, and one that is secular. So in other words, we're looking at a microcosm of the larger conflicts that are taking place in the Middle East. You've got one, you've got the Gaza Strip that is a holdout of the sort of Iranian or perhaps Saudi Arabian vision of what the Middle East should look like, and then you've got the West Bank, which is largely more moderate. One is supported by the moderate Sunni bloc. This is the West Bank. The other one is supported by the Iranian axis. So again, we're looking at a microcosm of the Shiite-Sunni divide. And we're seeing that these differences are very palpable and only serve to, I believe, divide the West Bank and Gaza Strip even further than they have been before. There are a couple of other things, little things to note about the differences between these two territories. Gaza has more than 40% of its population as refugees, whereas the West Bank has somewhere around 15 or 20, which means that poverty in the Gaza Strip is much higher than it is in the West Bank. Last year, the poverty levels were about 40% and 11% in the West Bank and Gaza, and we now know that after Operation Cast Lead, the disparity is growing, particularly after war and sanctions. There are different government structures now within these two territories, one controlled by Hamas, one controlled by Fatah. There are different police forces, security forces, intelligence forces, and then, of course, the funding sources. So what we're looking at right now is the fact that the two Palestinian territories, as a result of the Hamas-Fatah war, are splitting apart at an alarming rate. Now, to sum up, the events that have come to pass since the 07 Civil War have made U.S. diplomacy infinitely more challenging. We continue to talk about going back to the negotiating table and bringing the Palestinians to talk with the Israelis. But the question that I would ask the Obama administration and the State Department would be, who will you deal with? If you deal with Fatah, you are dealing essentially with an unelected government. In other words, Hamas won the Palestinian legislative elections in 2006 by a wide margin. This was the choice of the Palestinian people. However, if you deal with Fatah, you're dealing with a somewhat more moderate organization, at least one that is open to negotiation with Israel. And but the problem is there, again, you're looking at a population of about 2.5 million people based in the West Bank. And even then, I would not even say that that population is fully under Fatah control. There are reports coming out of Ramallah that Abbas is scarcely the chairman of the Mukasa compound in Ramallah, let alone the entire West Bank. In other words, there is fear that perhaps Hamas is growing. But yet again, this is the organization that will work with the United States, is accepting aid from the United States, and is working quite openly with Israel to help shore up security in the West Bank. Now, on the other hand, there are calls within the U.S. government to deal with Hamas. As I mentioned, this is the elected government. They won by a wide margin in 2006. The only problem here is that Hamas will not talk to Israel. They call it the Zionist entity, and it is a recognized terrorist organization. So working with Hamas, particularly here in Washington, would be would fly in the face of foreign policy dating back to the time of Richard Nixon, where it was determined that the U.S. would not negotiate with terrorists. So, but Hamas does control one, you know, one of the territories, about 1.5 million people, and is an elected government for better or for worse. So, in other words, what I would say is that there really is no good choice for the United States or Israel in terms of getting back to the negotiating table. And what we need is to truly figure out who the interlocutor is on the part of the Palestinian people. In other words, we cannot move forward with negotiation, despite the will and the energy that we have seen in Washington to jumpstart the peace process. There cannot be a peace process until we have figured out who speaks for the Palestinians and that they can come to the negotiating table and that the Israelis can begin to deal with them in good faith. Until we have that, and until we begin to perhaps address some of the problems that we're seeing from a geographic perspective that I mentioned earlier, the alarming split between the West Bank and Gaza, I believe that the peace process is doomed to fail again. And this is something that I am trying to impart to decision makers in Washington, that we are now at a critical juncture where the Palestinian internecine civil war has now eclipsed the larger Arab-Israeli conflict as the primary stumbling block towards peace in the region. So with that, Jennifer, I'll stop talking and be more than happy to answer questions.
Well, let me just remind the people who are on the telephone with us today that if you didn't already send in a question and would like to ask Mr. Shanzer a question, just send your email to michaelw@theisraelproject.org. And our first question comes from the Xinhua News Agency, their Jerusalem Bureau. Dear Mr. Shanzer, does the formation of a Palestinian unity government mean the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks will be irrelevant anymore?
Well, it's a good question, and it would really depend on the makeup of the Palestinian government. In other words, if it would be one that would be dominated by the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, which has renounced violence against Israel and has, in theory, accepted the existence of the Jewish state, there could be room for negotiation. In fact, we would expect it. We would expect the Palestinians to come back to the negotiating table. If, however, the Palestinians were to accept Hamas into a unity government and that the Hamas position would become a prominent one. In other words, non-recognition of the State of Israel, continued calls for the destruction of the Jewish state, it would be extremely difficult for the Israelis to come to the negotiating table in good faith. In other words, any negotiations that would take place, it would be temporary. It would be tahdiya, as the Palestinians would call it, or a temporary lull in violence, as opposed to a lasting peace agreement. So there would be really no incentive for the Israelis to come to the table if the Hamas positions were prominent within the Palestinian government. So we are going to have to wait and see how the Palestinians resolve their issues. But my my sense right now is that the Palestinians are nowhere near an agreement. Both sides, both Hamas and Fatah, are quite Machiavellian in their designs on the territories. I mean, both get a sense that eventually these territories could become a state. States are are not easy things to come by these days, the creation of new states. There's untold wealth and recognition and political power that would come with that. And neither side wants to give up on it. Neither side wants to give up the gains that they have. Hamas will not relinquish the Gaza Strip, and Fatah continues to rely on Israel and the United States and the international community to maintain its tight grip on the West Bank. So I don't suspect that either side will cede control. And, you know, the continued split between the West Bank and Gaza and the leadership will probably perpetuate the Palestinian conflict for months, if not years, to come.
My next question comes from David Brady, who asks, can the Palestinian people make a distinction between Hamas and Fatah, or are they both so corrupt and bad for the average person that they don't care who controls the West Bank and Gaza as long as they get a roof over their heads and food to eat?
Well, the Palestinian people differentiate between the two of them in a couple of significant ways. Hamas is seen as obviously a more religious, zealous organization that is hell-bent on the destruction of the State of Israel, and this appeals to the Palestinian people. Poll after poll shows that the tactic of suicide bombings and the indiscriminate Qassam rocket attacks that Hamas has launched into Israel over the last several years is something that is popular among the Palestinian people. Moreover, I would add that the Hamas organization is seen as one that has not been corrupted, and that it is honest about the way that it would spend its money and the way that it would try to develop a Palestinian government. On the Fatah side, the Palestinian people are frustrated with the fact that during the Oslo years, tens if not hundreds of millions of dollars poured into those territories, and none of that money trickled down. Most of the Fatah leaders have been revealed to be very corrupt and have pilfered a lot of those funds and now live in Cairo and in lush and lavish apartments and homes. And so the Palestinian people are very frustrated. But in fact, when we look at the ideologies of these two parties, they're very similar. If you look at the charter of the Hamas organization, you look at the charter of the Fatah organization, both openly call for the destruction of the State of Israel. Both organizations were founded by the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas is a distinct offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, whereas Fatah was founded by a number of members of the Muslim Brotherhood. And what's very interesting, actually, is just even the name Fatah. The name for the organization in Arabic is Harakat al-Tahrir al-Falastiniya, which means Palestinian Liberation Movement. The acronym for that should be HATAF, H-T-F. The Fatah founders decided to name the organization, they determined not to use that acronym, but to change the order to Fatah, which has a Quranic implication, means victory or conquest. So the idea was that Fatah was always going to try to appeal to at least a segment of the Islamist or Muslim population within the Palestinian people. So there is really not as much separating these two organizations as one might think. The tactics really right now are the difference. Fatah is willing to engage in negotiations. They probably still seek the destruction of the State of Israel, but have a longer time frame for it. Hamas seeks immediate engagement in warfare with Israel, and this is the primary difference between the two. And this, unfortunately, I think appeals to a broader segment of the Palestinian people at this time.
The next question from Robert Breslauer of Wisconsin asks, why can't Israel's IDF go in weekly to demolish the tunnels, especially while the mortars and rockets are coming in?
This is a very good question, and I think what we have seen from the IDF is that they would rather go in and in a wide-scale operation. I think given the international condemnation and the poor press that comes with this. Now, I don't believe that the Israelis for a minute think that bad press should overtake whatever military goals that Israel has. In other words, if lives are in danger, then Israel will need to do whatever it needs to do to protect its citizens. But there are other things that Israel has been doing along the way, using sonar equipment to try to find these tunnels and to destroy them. There is talk about flooding the Philadelphia corridor, the area where these tunnels pass through on the Egyptian Gaza border, where, in other words, right now the destruction of these tunnels has been done primarily with high explosives, and they will destroy the tunnels, but the Palestinians are able to quickly rebuild the tunnels and to make them operational again. Israel has been talking, at least from some of the folks that I've talked to over there, about digging some sort of a deep moat that would flood the tunnels and force them to collapse, making it almost impossible for them to rebuild. So there are going to have to be, I think, new tactics that the Israelis develop if they truly wish to stop these smuggling tunnels, which allows Hamas to import the rockets that they continue to fire in Israel, and the high-powered sniper rifles and the night vision goggles, all the equipment that Israel found that Hamas had during the most recent conflict.
Jerome Chapman asks, Mohammed Dahlan declared recently that Fatah has never recognized Israel and pointedly stated that Fatah does not want Hamas to recognize Israel, which it won't do anyway. How does this bear on ongoing and future dealings between the United States and Fatah? And actually, if you can, I can expand his question to include, does that impact some of the aid funding that's being discussed that would be distributed to the Palestinians?
You know, this is an excellent question and a vexing one, and one that, you know, I think deserves a lot more analysis, you know, in the State Department in Foggy Bottom here in Washington. Dahlan's statement should have not come as a surprise to anyone who's been following events in the region. What the Palestinians did in the late 1980s and really throughout the Oslo process was a little bit underhanded. The PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, accepted the existence of the State of Israel, where at the same time the Fatah organization, which makes up almost the entire PLO, in other words, the PLO is dominated by the Fatah party, never accepted the State of Israel. I encourage everyone on this call to go online and to look up the Fatah Charter. You will see that it very explicitly calls for the destruction of the State of Israel. So when Dahlan stated this, it should have come as no surprise. The way that the aid is flowing to the Palestinians right now is designed to go through the Palestinian Authority, not necessarily to Fatah itself. So the political party, even though it benefits from this aid, is not the the initial recipient. So it will trickle down from the Palestinian Authority or the PLO, which both accept the State of Israel. So in other words, there are layers of, I think, duplicity within the mainstream Palestinian leadership right now. I believe that you know, future aid should be conditioned upon Fatah also accepting the existence of the State of Israel. But this is something that Fatah will be reluctant to do. In other words, what we've seen, and I alluded to this during the call, is that the Hamas organization derives a lot of its popularity from its so-called steadfast resistance to the Zionist entity. In other words, the fact that they continue to attack Israel is a source of their popularity and is what essentially enables them to continue to operate with a mandate in the Gaza Strip. Fatah needs to compete with Hamas at this level. They will derive some of their legitimacy from also rejecting the Jewish state, and so it's sort of almost a popularity contest. As Fatah also calls for the destruction of the State of Israel or doesn't call upon Hamas to recant these calls, this is their way of trying to compete as a resistance organization which captures the imagination of the Palestinian people.
Ben Prybuk, from the director, who is the Director of Criminal Justice Studies, asked, what is the extent of penetration in Gaza and in the West Bank territories of Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, the Army of Islam and the Army of Believers? How much of a strategic threat does this represent for Israel and for the United States?
This is a terrific question, and one that I address with a full chapter in my book. What we have seen is that the first penetration by al-Qaeda into the Palestinian realm was in the Ain al-Hilweh camp, a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon, where a number of smaller groups, some actually associated with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the former third in command for al-Qaeda, who was killed in 2006, we've seen that that was the first layer of penetration for the al-Qaeda organization. After Hamas took over the Gaza Strip by force in June of 2007, reports began to trickle in of other al-Qaeda groups, Army of Islam, and several other smaller affiliate groups that were operating also inside the Gaza Strip. This is obviously of immense concern for Israel. You know, the idea of partnering up between Hamas and Al-Qaeda is sort of a worst nightmare for counter-terrorist analysts in Israel. What I can tell you thus far is that the influence of these organizations has been minimal. It's not to say that the danger doesn't still exist. It's just that we haven't seen a pervasive influence on the part of Al-Qaeda. What analysts are worried about and what I have heard is that the danger comes from the fact that Al-Qaeda thinks in a very grand scale and thinks about very symbolic, large attacks with, you know, large amounts of casualties. If some of the brain children, so to speak, of Al-Qaeda partner up with Hamas and provide them with ideas for attacks that are beyond the scope of what Hamas has typically done to date, we are looking at a broadening of the conflict between Israel and Hamas and a much more dangerous situation for Israel. In other words, up until today, we have seen that Hamas has been really limited to suicide bombings, which have undoubtedly created carnage in Israel. But the damage has been relatively limited. You know, you're not looking at thousands of casualties in one attack. You're looking at, you know, scores or dozens at worst, and they're gruesome, to you know, without question. But you know, they've been limited in scope. Similarly, the Qassam attacks, I mean, they are hit and miss. These Qassam rockets are homemade and fired indiscriminately into Israeli territory. Sometimes they will hit a target. Most of the time they will not. If Hamas and Al-Qaeda work together and find a way to attack Israelis on a mass scale, then we, again, are looking at a game changer, and one that will probably precipitate a full-scale Israeli invasion, and one that would probably make Operation Cast Lead pale in comparison.
Gary Gordon, contributing editor of the New English Review, asked, J Street recently released its second survey of American Jewish opinion that has one of the findings that, quote, American Jews as a whole understand that diplomatic engagement with Iran or with a unified Palestinian government, including Hamas, are essential Israeli and American interests. Given your new book, what is your view as the author of Hamas versus Fatah about engagement with Hamas?
Well, Jerry is a colleague, and he and I have appeared on a radio show together several times, and I think he poses an excellent question. You know, it is right now in vogue in Washington to talk about engaging with one's enemies. I mean, it's not just Hamas, but Iran and Syria. In my opinion, these sorts of conversations will go nowhere as long as the ideology of these states and entities do not change. You know, Iran still openly seeks the destruction of the state of Israel and is developing nuclear weapons and threatening to wipe Israel off the map. Engaging in discussions with Iran, I believe, would be fruitless at this stage. And similarly, engaging with Hamas will be fruitless. I wrote at length about this in a recent commentary article that appeared in February about the influence of Iran on Hamas and how Iran over the years has essentially bought and paid for the Gaza Strip by funding Hamas over the years. Hamas is now beholden to the Iranian regime and is a proxy, very much like Hezbollah. And we can expect Hamas to continue to openly call for the destruction of Israel and to openly attack it, either with Qassams or with suicide bombers or whatever means are available to them, essentially turning their attempting to engage in dialogue with Israel or accepting the state of Israel would mean turning their back on the Iranians, the only source of funding that they truly have that keeps them afloat. The Saudis curtailed their funding to Hamas in 2004 after they sustained a series of attacks by local Al-Qaeda groups. What the Saudis determined was that, you know, funding any Islamist organization on a large scale was a bad move for them. This is not to say that the Saudis have stopped their Islamist financing writ large, but they have scaled back considerably, and they have scaled back considerably with Hamas. So Hamas now relies almost entirely on Iran for its continued financing. And you know, and it's suffered under international sanctions, so it truly relies on Iran. And if it were to turn its back on Iran by working with Israel, it would mean essentially the financial unraveling of the Gaza Strip. So I don't see this happening anytime soon, and any attempt to engage with Hamas at this point, I believe, is going to be fruitful. Now, there are those who will say that, well, why not at least try? That's sort of the refrain that I'm hearing in Washington right now. The argument that I would make there is that you're essentially rewarding Hamas for decades of attacks against Israel. In other words, the only reason why they even have a seat at the negotiating table right now is because of their campaign of violence against civilians since 1988. This should not be rewarded, and this is something that, again, flies in the face of U.S. foreign policy dating back to the time of Richard Nixon. I believe that it has served America well over the decades, and I believe that it can continue to serve America well moving forward.
This is a question from Yaffa Gunner from Amherst, asks, what do most recent polls show about the attitudes of Palestinians in West Bank and Gaza towards peace with Israel?
Most of the Palestinians continue to say that they seek peace, but that are not terribly optimistic about achieving it. But one always has to ask, and by the way, these are the same sorts of things that we see in Israel, although I would say that the Israelis are probably even more pessimistic about the potential of achieving it, given the fractured Palestinian landscape. This is something that the Israelis are beginning to, I think, become increasingly aware of. When one talks about peace inside the territories, this is something that I have found fault with the polls that have been taken repeatedly. The primary pollster, the one who does most of the polls inside the territories, is a man named Khalil Shikaki. This is the same pollster who, by the way, predicted a Fatah victory in the 2006 elections, the January 2006 elections, that Fatah won. The polls, his polls, are not consistently accurate by any stretch of the imagination. But one of the things that has become very clear from his polls is that when they talk about peace, the terms of the peace are not terms that Israel would agree to. In other words, the peace that they talk about is a full withdrawal from Israel from the West Bank, and that complete control over Jerusalem for the Palestinians, or certain numbers of refugees being allowed to live in Israel. These are all things that Israel would never even agree to. So if the terms of peace were a little bit more accurate, I would be very interested to see what the what the perceptions would be on the ground in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. But broadly speaking, the Gaza Strip is a bit more radical under the Hamas control, more refugees, as I stated earlier, so you see less inclination on the part of those living in the Gaza Strip to want to engage in continued peace talks with Israel.
There are a number of people that are asking about Palestinian media, so I want to put in a plug for tomorrow's conference call that we're doing with Itamar Marcus that is on that topic. It's going to be a fantastic presentation. So I'm going to ask you instead, Jonathan, to address Shmuel Katz's question, which is what can be done to start educating the Palestinians to support peace instead of promoting hate?
This is a question for the ages. Part of it will have to do with the media. Part of it will have to do with textbooks. And I know that you've brought on experts on both of those subjects, this is not an area that has gone unnoticed by analysts. But my opinion is that we need to see a complete restructuring of the political landscape as well. The problem that we see right now, or that I observed, and I talk about this in the last chapter of my book, is the fact that both of the parties involved in this internecine conflict, the Palestinian Civil War, is that neither party provides a forward-looking vision for a Palestinian state. In other words, both parties, their ideologies are based more on the destruction of the state of Israel rather than the creation of a policy that will provide for the Palestinians well into the future. There is no Mahatma Gandhi. There is no Martin Luther King. There is no Nelson Mandela within the Palestinian political landscape right now. This will be critical if the Palestinians are ever to move out of this morass that they find themselves in right now. There is no way out because no one is providing an alternative, a different political view of how things may be. In other words, if somebody could come out and say, we want to live in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip as it is, and here is our vision for a state that we will build that will be economically viable, that will have peaceful relations with its neighbors, and that will be a contributing member of the League of Nations. This is not, I think you would begin to see things change very drastically for the Palestinian people, but that kind of individual has not yet really come to the fore. There are, and I also talk about this in the book, there are a couple of parties that have emerged. One is called the Palestine Forum, which is founded by a Palestinian billionaire. He's sort of the Bill Gates of the Palestinian community. There's one called Wasatiyah, which means middle ground, another one that's called the Third Way. The problem is that these parties are still in their infancy. They do not have the popularity, and they have not captured the imagination of the Palestinian people. We need them to begin to take hold, parties that reject violence and want to offer up that forward-looking vision of a Palestinian state. When that happens, I guarantee you we'll begin to see at least some signs of change.
Robert Ratner asks, what motivates both Hamas and Fatah to want to destroy Israel instead of improving their own existence?
This is something that is rooted very much in Palestinian history, and I wish that it wasn't. It is part of the Palestinian national narrative, that of destroying the state of Israel. It's what they have been talking about from pre-1948 and after 1948. The idea has always been not just simply, again, to create a Palestinian state, but rather to destroy the Israeli state that they believe is on the land that they claim is theirs. So this is what continues to motivate them and what continues to drive the ideology and the tactics of violence we could say personify the Arab-Israeli conflict today. I mean, this is what perpetuates it. Again, we are looking for that new forward-looking vision and have not seen it.
As Azrael Saporta of California asked, do you believe the rift between Fatah and Hamas is to Israel's benefit, and could that be one of the reasons Israel has not tried harder to actually eliminate Hamas, especially in the latest CAF-led operation?
It's an interesting question that I have posed, and I think it's a research question worth looking into further. I would say that right now the support that Israel and the United States are providing to Fatah, which is nominal support. This is not, strengthening it to the point that it can reconquer the Gaza Strip or really dominate the Palestinian arena. This would be something akin to the United States supporting Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War. There is a school of thought that would say that keeping these two sides at war with one another, will take some of the pressure off of Israel, at least right now. You'll see less attacks against Israel proper because they are so consumed with their own factional fighting. This, in my opinion, though, is probably only a short-term solution to a larger problem. The Palestinians will eventually sort out their differences. I don't know when. I don't expect it to happen anytime soon. But it's quite possible that when those differences are settled, you will be looking at a more radical Islamist polity. It is likely right now that Hamas would win if there was a battle that took place inside the West Bank, and certainly from a political perspective, if elections were to take place in 2010, as the Palestinians suggest, you would see Hamas win yet again. So then Israel would be dealing with an Islamist organization that sought its destruction in the form of a quasi-state. This is unacceptable to Israel, and I believe that Israel needs to perhaps use the time that it has bought right now looking at this internecine conflict and perhaps use that to come up with a strategy. And I have not seen that strategy yet on how to truly eliminate Hamas. As long as Hamas dominates the Palestinian landscape, there will be no peace with Israel. And I would actually even say that even with Fatah, I mean, to have ambivalent talks about or ambivalent ideas about talks with Israel is not enough to move forward with peace. Again, we need to find that new Palestinian leadership that has been slow, if not absent entirely.
Michael Weiser asked, the administration would have us believe that Hamas is the only instrument of terror within the Palestinian territories. Is it true that that Fatah is, at least from a recent perspective, clean from the perspective of terrorist activity?
Absolutely not. FATA is the lesser of two evils, and there's no question about it. I've said this throughout the call. There is no good side necessarily here. You've got the FATA organization was founded in the 1950s based on the idea that terror would be necessary to liberate Palestine, so to speak. And throughout the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, the word Palestinian or PLO or FATA were synonymous with terrorism. It was throughout in the late 1980s and into the 90s when Yasser Arafat determined that it was in his best interest to negotiate with Israel but continued to call for its destruction privately and in Arabic. And then in 2000, Fatah reverted back to its terrorist ways. So the organization right now, probably the main reason why it is not engaged in a full campaign against Israel is because it realizes that it needs Israel and it needs the United States in order to even maintain the level of power that it has now, which has been significantly reduced. So you're looking at a more pragmatic organization with its back up against the wall that has lost popularity and that is really doing whatever it can to stay afloat. That's what Fatah is doing now. If it strengthens and if it gets to a point where it's able to stand on its own two feet, I have doubts about whether it would continue in its discussions with Israel towards peace. One cannot also forget that the Fatah organization maintains the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade within its ranks. This is an Islamist organization that is essentially modeled after the Hamas organization. So we are not looking at a peaceful organization by any stretch of the imagination. We are looking at one that has adopted negotiation as a tactic, as a means to survive.
Fred Hayward asks, you said that Palestinians have no Gandhi, no Martin Luther King, no Nelson Mandela. But Gandhi was assassinated, King was assassinated, and while Mandela was, quote-unquote, safely in jail. What is your scenario on how such a leader could emerge in Palestine and survive?
Well, you know, and this raises another excellent question. I mean, the idea of a Palestinian moderate is one that we have not seen yet. We have seen certain individuals or factions within the Fatah organization come out as inclined to engage in peace talks, but we have not seen, someone who openly calls for nonviolence. The way that power is brokered in the Arab world, and this holds also for the Palestinian territories, is that those who hold the guns are those who control the streets, and those who control the streets control the government. And this has always been the case, and it's one of the reasons why Hamas, I believe, won the elections in 2006 and was able to take control in 2007. Their strength has grown over time. So the question is, how does one project that kind of strength without embracing violence? And, this is a question that remains to be seen. But I believe that, the perpetuation of the Arab-Israeli conflict can be attributed to the fact that, we have not found that that Mahatma Gandhi or that Martin Luther King yet. And, yes, there would be a danger if someone of that caliber came out in support of nonviolence. That person's life would be in danger, but this is the case throughout the Arab world and the challenge that we continue to deal with. If things are ever going to change, we're going to have to see that voice emerge.
Well, if I can push back a little on your answer where you said there aren't any moderates during this recent incident with Gaza where Israel was forced to defend its citizens by having a fairly aggressive stance vis-a-vis the terrorism that was coming out of Gaza, the statements by Abbas and Fayyad and others were fairly supportive of Israel's right to defend its people in that they were critical of Hamas for having continued to shoot rockets into Israel. What's your comment on the comments that they made during the Gaza war?
Well, and I mentioned that up front, and I thought it was really a sea change in the way that the Arab-Israeli conflict has played out, in the Palestinian political sphere. What was interesting to me was to see this sort of support, especially during the first week when Operation Cast Lead was an air operation. The rhetoric changed drastically on Abbas's and Fayyad's part after Israeli boots were on the ground. And that's when the condemnation and the talks of heavy-handedness and disproportionate force and all that kind of stuff began to come out again. You know, this is not to say that these two leaders aren't somewhat moderate. And, you know, they are. But they are also part of a Fatah organization that has yet to renounce the destruction of the State of Israel. So they are playing a sort of a duplicitous game. I believe, by the way, that Fayyad is probably the best chance that the Palestinians have for a moderate leader. The only problem with him is that you know, he actually resigned recently during the month of March as these reconciliations took place in Cairo, and so his political future is uncertain. And Abbas, you know, has been a weak leader and has vacillated back and forth between Holocaust denial and denying the legitimacy of the State of Israel, and then coming out in support of Israeli air operations when they are attacking his foe in Gaza. So we're seeing a lot of mixed messages, and that's not exactly the sorts of things that shore up confidence on the Israeli side or the American side as we look forward to potential negotiations in the future.
Speaking of mixed messages, there were many calls by analysts during the war, during the election in Israel. The Gaza war was already over, and yet rockets were still coming into Israel from Gaza, that perhaps Hamas was enabling more rockets to come into Israel as a way to try and encourage people to vote for a right-wing government, with the thought that a right-wing government would not be talking to Fatah. Do you believe that analysis, or do you think that they were not connected?
You know, I have heard this a couple of times throughout recent Israeli history. There was talk during the late 1990s when Benjamin Netanyahu was prime minister for the first time that Hamas determined that it was not going to attack Israel during this time to help shore up the political standing of Netanyahu, who was opposed to peace. So in other words, there are lots of theories out there about how Hamas wants to ensure that a more right-wing government that would be opposed to peace would stay in Israel, or that would be voted in Israel. I don't know whether Hamas is that smart or whether they've truly thought through this. I believe that the failure of the Olmert government in 2006 to effectively, execute a war against Hezbollah was probably the beginning of the end for Kadima, and then the corruption charges leveled against Olmert have made things even worse. And then Tzipi Livni's inability to create a new coalition after Olmert stepped down essentially led the Israeli public to believe that the sort of middle ground politics don't work for Israel. And I believe that's why Netanyahu came in. Yes, the fact that rockets continue to fire into Israel, or that there was a war that took place right before the election, I think probably helped his chances, but I don't know if this was necessarily engineered by Hamas in any way.
Now, since the election, and Israel is now trying to form a government, we've seen very few statements coming from Fatah on the formation of the government. Do you have a sense of what they're looking for, or whether this matters on the Israeli-Palestinian track, and what Hamas's views are about the new government?
Well, you know, both sides, I've seen spokespeople from both Hamas and Fatah come out and condemn Netanyahu as right-wing, and obviously Avigdor Lieberman, who was a polarizing figure during the elections, who's now likely going to be the foreign minister under the new Netanyahu government. Both Netanyahu and Lieberman have been vilified by the Palestinians, and I would say that this narrative is beginning to take hold. If anybody watched the press conference with the president last night, there was a reporter from AFP who got up and essentially asked the question of, what will Obama do now that there are these two right-wing figures who are anti-peace. I'm paraphrasing, but this is essentially the question that he posed to Obama: what will Obama do about the negotiations? Ironically, I believe that this doesn't necessarily bode poorly for the peace process. If the Palestinians are somehow able to get their act together and to find that interlocutor to come to the negotiating table, and Netanyahu is the prime minister and negotiates on behalf of Israel, you've got a better chance of a peace agreement that would last. In other words, it took somebody like Richard Nixon to go to China because he was right of center and because he was looking out for America's best interests. I would say the same thing holds for Israel right now. But the two Palestinian factions will continue to try to cast Netanyahu as the impediment to peace. What they are really doing, though, is trying to cover up the fact that they have yet to figure out who speaks for them. The Palestinians have been doing this now for really the last year and a half, or maybe even more, trying to paper over the fact that there is no unity between the Palestinians. There is no interlocutor, as I've said, you know, repeatedly on this call, and this is going to be the primary impediment towards Arab-Israeli negotiations. Now, Obama, to his credit, mentioned that last night and said that, you know, the Palestinian landscape was cloudy, but I believe that the Palestinians are on a sort of a campaign to cast Netanyahu as the impediment, when I believe actually the opposite is the case, that if an agreement was struck with Netanyahu, it would be one that would be ironclad.
Well, Jonathan Chanzer, it's been a real delight to speak with you about your new book, Hamas versus Fatah, The Struggle for Palestine. If somebody wants to go out and buy your book, where can they find it?
You can find it on Amazon, or you can contact me directly. My email is jschanzer, J-S-C-H-A-N-Z-E-R, at jewishpolicycenter.org. So I'm happy to provide you with a copy here, or just simply find it on Amazon or in any bookstore.
Terrific. Well, we're delighted to have so many people on the call with us today, and we hope that people will come back tomorrow to hear Itamar Marcus talking about what's going on in the Palestinian media, in textbooks and other cultural institutions. Very important talk tomorrow. Again, Jonathan Chanzer, thank you so much for being with us, and thanks to all of you who were on the call today.